Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 10-0802, Michigan Consolidated ISD versus Gloria Garcia.
May it please the court. Mr. Hansen will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Please the court and counsel. The standard for waivers of sovereign immunity is that any waiver must be clear and unambiguous. And it's just as heck as you put it in Kerrville. That means unmistakable clarity as to that waiver, particularly when we're talking about who the waiver is applicable against. In the Texas Labor Code, the legislature clearly and unambiguously waived the sovereign immunity of state agencies, and it clearly and unambiguously waived the sovereign immunity of state instrumentalities, and it clearly and unambiguously waived the governmental immunity of counties and municipalities. But it clearly and unambiguously did not waive the governmental immunity of school districts because it was not included within the definition of employer.
It is not
now there, and it has never been there. So they're not even referred to within the Texas Labor Code at all. School districts are never mentioned in there.
So
it was error to construe the Labor Code as waiving the sovereign immunity of school districts.
You say you're a political subdivision.
We are a political subdivision, Your Honor. That's correct.
And the Tort Claims Act includes school districts in that category.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't we look to that?
Well, if you do look to that, apply the principle of inclusio unius est exclusio alterius, and you'll see that within the definition of the Texas Labor, or in the Labor Code, you'll see that school districts are not included. Only counties and municipalities are included within that definition.
But it says political subdivisions. That's another category.
But within the Labor Code, but that is a defined term in the Labor Code, and the definition is limited to counties and municipalities, which are not school districts. They're very different things. And normally, Your Honor, when political subdivisions are referred to, you'll see that they will be broken out. As a matter of fact, if you look at the election code, 1.005 of the election code, where it describes what a political subdivision is, you'll see that it is that they actually refer to school districts by name, along with counties and municipalities. Even further, when you take a look at this statute and you see that they did actually at one point contemplate educational institutions, you'll see that they've narrowed that category to just institutions of higher education. And so when the legislature had a chance to include school districts in their normal category of political subdivision, they did not. And the interesting part of this is that actually counties and municipalities are named specifically as employers. But the provision that you're talking about, Justice Heck, with regard to political subdivisions, that relates to the waiver or the ability to sue an elected official of a political subdivision. And so in this case, you can sue elected officials of counties, elected officials of municipalities, but not boards of trustees.
One always hopes that the legislature is trying to make sense. Why would they exclude school districts?
There's excellent reason to exclude school districts, Your Honor, and it's because they're an incredibly large employer within the state of Texas. There's an incredible amount of liability that's bound up potentially with that, and you can see that sort of process at work if you look at the Texas Tort Claims Act, where you can see that when they were trying to determine whether or not, who should be liable, they said governmental entities. And then they broke it down further and said there's state entities and there are local government entities. And under those local government entities, they had schools. And that would have been fine. But you can see then that later on in the statute, they then narrow down the scope of liability for school districts, or rather the scope of that waiver of governmental immunity for school districts, just to use or operation of a motor vehicle. So it's clear that when the legislature makes a decision, it is contemplating all of these possible ramifications, and not only for the finances of the school district, but but also other implications, such as where the state has to spend probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, assigning workers from the Texas Workforce Commission to investigate claims. So it's not just the liability side of the coin, it's the overall expenditure of funds that the legislature, that the state is allowed to consider. How much money does it wish to put in there? Or would it rather spend its money educating students and paying teachers to provide that education?
Excuse me, let me just kind of switch gears a little bit. If we decide that Garcia hasn't established a prima facie case, then do we even need to get to any of the other issues except for attorney's fees?
No, Your Honor, you do not. And I think the interesting thing about that question is that it's one of the questions that Justice Gray addressed in his dissent in Purdon versus Coppers Cove Economic Development Corporation. And that's one of the cases that was cited in Garcia 1 as supporting this waiver idea. But as Justice Gray said in that case, when the analysis begins in the majority's opinion with it's undefined what the meaning of state instrumentality is, and it's unclear as to what its meaning is, and therefore we'll apply this 8-part test to determine what the legislature intended, then by its very nature, it is not a clear and unambiguous waiver of sovereign immunity. It is not clear, as admitted by the courts. The other court to admit this was in Funderburk, which was the other case that was cited by this court, which said that the term is undefined. Undefined means indefinite, and indefinite means ambiguous. Thus, by the very holdings of the courts that this court relied on, the justices in the majorities in those cases acquiesced to the fact that it was not clear and unambiguous, and that is the important standard. And in those cases, I bring those up because the school districts have been absolutely defined out of everything else. The only possible pool would perhaps be the state instrumentality. But as you pointed out, Justice Heck, normally we're considered to be a political subdivision. That's the normal mode. We're considered to be a local government entity, and that's how we've been treated in all of the other waivers of sovereign immunity. Look to the Texas Local Government Code, where they recently waived the sovereign immunity of school districts for breach of contract claims.
I think we didn't already say in the first round that the waiver applies to school districts.
Your Honor, I think it wasn't with that level of specificity, and I think it was on the nature of an implied holding, which was similar to the, and thus an implied finding of a waiver of sovereign immunity, which I think is similar to what happened in Kerrville versus Fernandez, where there is a decision to imply the waiver, though there wasn't a thorough analysis, as this court has done over and over again in these cases with the state hospitals and it's been very consistently applied, and we're simply asking that the court consider this and apply that same standard of analysis to this case.
If your jurisdictional argument is correct, wouldn't that mean that the legislature decided that an employee who is discriminated against, even if clearly so, in a school district, would have no recourse for that discrimination in Texas state courts?
Absolutely not, because somebody can still file a Title VII claim if they wish to do so. So there is that avenue, and if they wish to have it heard in state court, they certainly they can certainly do that, because that would be the federal case. And there's,
I think, they could pursue the same claims under the mirror federal statute, Title VII.
Yes, Your Honor, potentially, and as a matter of fact, in many ways, the state and the federal have merged, at least in the initial claims handling process. It would simply alleviate the state from having to fund the investigations for those claims. So it would be a significant, probably there's no evidence in the record of what the significance would be, but when you imagine that there's over 1,000 school districts in the state of Texas, and there's a significant amount of resources that are applied by the state in order to fund the investigatory part of the TWC, that burden would be alleviated quite a great deal. But as far as school districts being able to discriminate, absolutely not. But and no more so than the absolutely not, Your Honor.
What is your take on the proper sequencing, of how we ought to tackle issues? Tackle waiver first before getting to whether the prima facie elements have been met or the opposite?
Yes, I believe that the waiver would have to be addressed first, because really that disposes of the rest of the issues. If the court determines that we are not clearly and unmistakably an employer under the Act.
But the reverse would also be true, right, if we decided the prima facie issue first?
Well, if you decided the prima facie issue first and then proceeded to decide the jurisdictional issue,
didn't, because it takes care of it.
Right. Or if you didn't decide the jurisdictional issue, of course, one of the things that's happening is, or rather, not the jurisdictional issue, they're all jurisdictional issues, but rather the issue with regard to the whether or not a school district is an employer. If you don't address that, then by inference, you're adopting the unclear and ambiguous standard that the lower courts have adopted in construing state instrumentality to mean that's a school district. And I don't think that after the years and years that this court has put into firmly establishing what that means and what the legislature has done to ensure that that is the standard, I don't think that would be the appropriate thing for the court to do, because it can have all sorts of other effects, and certainly there wouldn't be any certainty as to who is a state instrumentality going forward.
You argue that if you replace the worker with an older worker, there can't be age discrimination. Why doesn't that rule find greater voice in the federal circuits?
Well, it's interesting. They are split on that, Your Honor. There are some circuits that have stated that. I believe that there are folks, as stated in the AARP brief, that will say, well, you just can't account for the lowly nature of people and what kind of depth they'll sink to harm one another. And I think that fear of not wanting to leave something open to that has probably led to that sort of decision. But I think that when you provide evidence that shows that the person that you hired was actually older than the person that you let go, assuming that lowly nature is not in the record, that you can't show that age by itself, that objective factor of age, was the motivating factor. Maybe it was something else. Maybe it was something they didn't like about that person. But the labor code provision is written really as a protection of age, and not just age, it's protection for people who are older from being replaced by people who are younger. And that's really the main point of it. In this case, the questions of on the issue of whether or not you could otherwise prove it are really not properly before the court, because they had a chance to otherwise prove it at the jurisdictional hearing, and it's probative evidence to the material issue of whether or not age, that characteristic, was a part of of a motivating factor, which of course is the standard. It's probative evidence, and so in response, they needed to come with probative evidence to the contrary, that age was not age was a motivating factor. Rather,
conceptually, what if the fired employee just looks a whole lot older than the one who's hired in replacement, who may be a little older?
Sort of the Anderson Cooper question, isn't it? You have a 35-year-old person who's gone prematurely gray, and you wonder, did the legislature really intend for somebody like Anderson Cooper to be able to file a suit even though they weren't 40? No, they didn't. It was the age characteristic that they were protecting. And so until they reach that age, then the issue of motivating factor never really becomes an issue. I understand how that can be a concern, but it is an appearance-based distinction, and not strictly speaking, an age-based distinction, because there's no perfect correlation between those two. And as we look through the labor code cases, there really aren't any of these sort of proxy cases that exist in the Texas labor code. Nothing is really boiled up as we're taking this facially neutral characteristic and using it as a proxy for age. And of course, typically those only arise in those in the disparate impact type of cases.
Excuse me, let me ask another question. Let's say if we were to determine that section 21.254 is jurisdictional, then what is your position with regard to the issue of Garcia's diligence in obtaining service under these facts?
I think that if it's jurisdictional, then diligence is not an issue. It has to be strictly construed, and that 60 days ends, and that they no longer have the power, the authority, or the discretion to file that suit after that. And of course, if we're talking about strictly construing those timelines, then what we're absolutely talking about here is that that's it.
If they but what about her diligence? If there was
diligence is a construct that was created to sort of equitably toll that. And of course, we have a legislative enactment that says you have to strictly construe those, and they're jurisdictional, all those prerequisites to suit, and an idea that a judicially created idea of equitable tolling. Well, of course, the statute is going to control the equitable tolling part, and to the extent that 254 has ever been construed in the past as simply being equitable or permissive, with the enactment of the addition to 311.034, under the rules of statutory construction, 311.034 prevails because it was the later enacted statute. And as a matter of fact, I would say that the May language is what most people key off of, and they say, well, May is a permissive sort of word. Well, May just goes to whether they can file the suit or not. May actually has
a defined... What about bring? What does it mean to bring?
To bring means to file and to serve the suit. Otherwise, they would have said file.
Sorry, bring means to file
and serve the suit.
And where do you get that?
That's from the several cases, the Education Service Center that I've cited in my brief. But it does mean to file and serve, and that's how it's been treated throughout.
We haven't addressed that language, though. Bring means to file and serve.
To file and serve.
Strictly construing certainly is something that we're required to do and do on occasion. We're bound, however, to strictly construe the words that are provided.
Yes.
And we can't make it stricter than it appears to be. You agree with that?
I agree with that, Your Honor, of course.
The question is, what does bring mean, I suppose?
Bring has been treated as filing and or to file and to serve, and that has existed for since the 90s. And so this statute has existed in this way for that amount of time. There hasn't been any changes or attempts to modify it to simply say filing. But it has been treated as, in some cases, sometimes mandatory, but not jurisdictional.
The U.S. Supreme Court in the Irwin case, though, held that it should strictly construe a statute, but still found this equitable tolling exception. Why isn't that instructive here in this context? That was in the Title VII case.
It was in a Title VII case, but I think what we have to do is apply what the Texas legislature said, and particularly in light of considering that it seemed to be an answer to the Lautenheiser case, in which the court had determined that the notice provision was mandatory but not jurisdictional. And I think that response from the legislature is probably more instructive than Irwin on how the Texas legislature would like to treat the waivers of sovereign immunity it has enacted. I've run out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Ms. Robinson will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Hansen. Mr. Hansen speaks from the heart. His heart is in trying to exempt the school districts from the application of the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act. And he's absolutely correct that we construe waivers of sovereign immunity strictly. But the legislature is not required to indulge in an endless listing of synonyms. there is no reason to find that governmental entities, that political subdivisions, are anything other than the school. There's no reason to find that the school is not an employer. In fact, the argument is that because it's an employer, great savings could be had, although great injustice may be inflicted, by refusing to apply the equal rights statutes, the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act, that protects race, national origin, and age. Discrimination is the use of an irrelevant characteristic to make employment decisions. We have determined in this country that age, gender, race are irrelevant characteristics. What matters is the qualifications of the employees. And in fact, studies done in the 1960s, when Lyndon Baines Johnson was pushing these statutes through, tended to show that discrimination costs business. It costs the school districts an equal amount to be subject to discrimination. This case comes out of the Valley. Some of you may be familiar with the Valley. In the Valley, they play school district politics like it's a full contact sport. Full contact sport.
Is that just limited to the Valley?
It's the only one I have experience with. But there are many, many examples where, for example, in Donna Edcouch, there was a school board election Saturday night, and on Sunday morning, all the locks had been changed, and 24 people lost their job.
Well, let's talk about this case. Your client was replaced by somebody similar age, and the argument is that defeats your claim.
Three reasons it should not defeat the claim. First is the accepted standard is for the fourth test, replaced by someone younger or otherwise discriminated against. Why otherwise discriminated against in a replacement case? One, we don't know whether the person who fired Gloria Garcia was the same person who hired Ms. Longoria. We know who fired Gloria Garcia. It was the principal. And he could have a discriminatory animus. And somebody in HR, in the human resources department, hires Mrs. Longoria and does not have that same animus. Second reason, I absolutely agree with Judge Hecht that just because one person is not discriminated against doesn't mean a different person was not discriminated against. Analogy. You have a young man who comes back from war. He doesn't like Orientals. Maybe he's been to Vietnam. There are two truck drivers in his shipping department. One's named Gwen, spelled with an N. Another one's named Smith, but clearly Oriental. He fires Gwen based on the paperwork, based on the last name. He retains Smith. Smith is also Oriental. Is it any different that can you say that Gwen was not discriminated against because Smith was retained? No, of course not. You can have discrimination against one person and bypass the next.
But this is a rehire. This is hiring somebody else.
Yes, sir.
So how can you say that the school district, which may have had different actors at different times, I guess I can see that, was discriminatory with respect to age if it hired an older employee? It seems like that's impossible.
Because the same thing that happens with a corporation happens in a school district. You have a principal who may have a discriminatory animus, and you may have a different person entirely who does not. And the fact that there were two different people treated differently, although they were both of a similar age, doesn't mean the first person was not discriminated
against. But doesn't that mean your age case is tenuous? And if they're discriminating against two people, but they fire one of a certain age, then hire a replacement that's 3 years older, that really makes an age case hard to prove. Maybe you're arguing some other type of discrimination, but they hired someone older.
You make an excellent point, Justice Wainwright. And the reason that that is so important is that we're here on the plea to the jurisdiction stage. After 10 years of litigation, this happened in 2003, we have still not completed discovery, we still don't have the full facts, and the standard of proof, the burden of proof, is different here than it would be in a summary judgment.
Should we look to the fact that there's a replacement case and a reduction in force case, and how does that impact our analysis, although I realize the line is not as bright as has been suggested?
I disagree with that proposition, although the seductive part about it is that, of course, when you have a reduction in force, you don't have a replacement. And that's seductive. That makes common sense. But it still doesn't go, and it still doesn't make sense to me that if you don't discriminate against one person, you haven't discriminated against a different person. It may be that one person looks older, the Anderson Cooper argument. It may be that one person's skin is whiter. But the fact that one person is not discriminated against, even if that person is a replacement, does not necessarily entail that the person who was discriminated against is, as a matter of law, not discriminated against.
So at this plea to the jurisdiction stage, we are not yet looking to this non-discriminatory reason which would be proffered by the employer. And you may end up at some point still losing because since she was replaced with an older worker. I mean, they could articulate a valid non-discriminatory reason.
Correct, Justice Guzman. We are here at the stage of determining whether the court has jurisdiction to hear those summary judgments later.
Because the common sense, I guess, approach is, look, you failed to state a claim because under any circumstances you're not going to be able to prove age discrimination because she was replaced with someone older. But so why can't we look to that? I know what stage is this. Why can't we look to it?
I think everyone agrees that if we've stated a prima facie case, the court has jurisdiction. And the fourth prong says replaced by someone younger or otherwise discriminated against. We don't have the facts that say that she was not otherwise discriminated against. Our pleadings set up the court's jurisdiction. It then becomes incumbent on the school district to negate that. They contend that they have negated that fourth prong by half of the standard.
Well, even the federal courts are not consistent in whether you can rely on that fourth prong in this type of case. The authority is not consistent on that point. And some say you can't rely on that fourth prong in this type case.
That's correct. And I think the AARP brief has done an excellent job of laying all that out. The majority of the federal courts, the United States Supreme Court, and prior decisions of this court would tend to hold that the otherwise discriminated against provision applies even to replacement cases.
Let's go back to the pleading point that you were making just a minute ago with Justice Guzman. With regard to an age case, age discrimination case, why doesn't O'Connor versus Consolidated Coin, U.S. Supreme Court case in 1996, resolve that? It said the, quote, inference of illegal discrimination cannot be drawn from the replacement of one worker with another worker insignificantly younger. And this case is probably clearer because the replacement was not just insignificantly younger, but was 3 years older. The U.S. Supreme Court said you cannot draw an age discrimination inference in those types of cases.
The United States Supreme Court in the O'Connor case was looking at the first half of the fourth standard, the fourth element. I don't think the O'Connor case can correctly be cited to say that the second half doesn't exist. In fact, subsequent cases have held that it's a very flexible standard. And I confess that I'm not as familiar with United States Supreme Court law as I ought to be, but the AARP brief does a very excellent job of laying all that out.
In this context, they were otherwise discriminated against. What would we be looking at here with this worker and her replacement?
Who did the hiring and who did the firing? If it was the same person, then perhaps we would lose a summary judgment. If it is actually an acknowledgement of guilt, if it is actually that the HR department goes in and says, Mr. Principal, you really can't do this way. You know, we've got to make up for this. If it's an acknowledgement of guilt by somebody else in the school district with the authority to bind the school district, then you've got age discrimination as to my lady.
So if the same person did the hiring and the firing, I guess you'd have to inquire as to whether initially they fired her because she was older, and then, as you say, someone stepped in and
would you make the same
argument? had them take a different course with that action?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has to do with the animus of the actor. It has to do with the animus of the entity.
So how will you ever not prove a prima facie case? Because it seems to me that could always be true, that the individual actor had a discriminatory animus. Even if the company always hired women or always hired older people or always hired a minority, it seemed like you could always say, yes, but this particular person on this particular day held an animus.
And if that's true, all we've done is given the court the authority and jurisdiction to determine those motions for summary judgment.
Which means?
And if we lose, we lose. But it's a very small step. It's not that expensive. It doesn't take 10 years to go to the Supreme Court twice.
But all I'm saying is you're really arguing against having to make a prima facie case.
No, not really. What I'm saying is that absent some compelling proof that the court has jurisdiction to hear the case and determine the merits. And as Justice Wainwright says, it may be a very weak case, but being a weak plaintiff doesn't deprive the court of jurisdiction.
What impact, if any, does the passing of your client have on us?
Oh, it's...
to reach a decision.
For this court, it makes no decision. For me, of course, it makes a very big decision. The passing of my client shows the futility of the interlocutory appeal in this case. And I don't know that this court even has the authority to consider such things, but we've got to do something to make people bring their interlocutory appeals earlier in the case. Because otherwise people die, witnesses disperse, and nobody cares except the lawyers. You know, Gloria never saw her name brought up to the standard she felt she deserved. She died still unemployed, still being called a thief. I mean, it was a truly tragic situation. I just hope that her name does not go down in the annals of this court as making bad law. It's really important not only to the ARP, but to anyone who's got a little white in their hair, that the court acknowledge that there is a flexible burden of proof, that you can show in more ways than one that you have been discriminated against.
Would you take the what's been called the Anderson Cooper analogy and apply it to race and sex as well? Because the replacement here, as you know, was of the same race, Hispanic, and the same sex, a woman. So would you take the same arguments you've made about age and you apply them in race and sex context as well?
I believe the United States Supreme Court has already done it with race, and I would certainly do it with gender and other things. There is such a variation, not in the evil nature of humans, but in the good nature of humans. An engineer doesn't think that women engineers can do math, so he fires one lady, but the other lady who comes to him after work and says, please help me with my calculations, he keeps. Has he not discriminated against the first? His animus, his belief is that women can't do math, and that's clearly wrong. It's clearly an irrelevant characteristic. So, yes, I think the United States Supreme Court has already headed that way, and it should go across the board. There should be a flexible ability to show true facts, and if they are discriminatory, they are. If they're not, then we lose on summary judgment, but not on a plea to the jurisdiction.
Ms. Robinson, can you jump back to waiver?
Yes, sir.
And we've talked about, of course, the waiver has to be clear and unambiguous. And Mr. Hansen talks about the labor code definition of political subdivision, which goes through a laundry list, but it leaves out school districts. And I understand your point about that working a grave injustice, but can you give me a more kind of text-based discussion?
Text-based discussion. Not really, but what I can tell you is that I believe the legislature doesn't do stupid things all the time, and having an endless list of synonyms, you know, how many synonyms do you want to have for governmental entities? Do we want to talk about administrative courts, tribunals, JPs. I mean, where do you draw the line at ending the list of synonyms? I think school districts are in some of the other terms.
Right. Well, if they include school districts, for example, in the Tort Claims Act, but they omit them in the labor code, did we draw nothing significant from that disparate treatment, I guess?
I would not. And partially because my interest is that way, but also partially just as common sense. If you have two different bodies, you know, 158 different men and women voting, you can't have that kind of unanimity. If it was a single person, yes. If it was a single body, like the Texas Supreme Court, that has a history of reviewing its work.
Because we have to assume they didn't do something absurd, but we also have to assume they intended what they enacted.
Yes.
I mean, how do we sort of balance those two presumptions? We presume they didn't do a foolish thing, but we presume that they did what they intended to do.
Mm-hmm. And the law has been fairly clear on this. I mean, this one case in 2008, you guys said that immunity had been waived. The legislature has met once, twice since then, and it hasn't changed it. So I don't think you can draw a conclusion that your earlier decision was erroneous. Because if the legislature is that well thought out, they would have corrected an error. If there are no further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson. The court will hear rebuttal.
I hope that the court remembers when it goes to write this decision that there is a record in this case. And in this case, nobody was prohibited from providing other evidence of discrimination. Remember, this is not just a pleading on the pleadings, but it is also a Miranda-style plea to the jurisdiction where we offered evidence to rebut one of the elements of their case. So it isn't simply a case of did she plead all of her claims.
But can you take up her hypothetical? I'm the employer, and I don't like old people, and so I fire you. And then somebody else hires a person who is older, doesn't have the same sort of animus. Either that, or I fire you because you're older, I don't like older people. But my general counsel then says that was a terrible error, and we can immunize ourselves if we hire somebody older. What about those two scenarios?
I'm not saying that that couldn't possibly occur at some point in time. I'm just saying that that's not in this record. That's not in these pleadings, and there was no evidence whatsoever that was proffered to rebut our presumption or rebut the evidence that we provided on the material fact of motivating factor.
But they pled generally or otherwise discriminated against. On that pleading, potentially, they could go get discovery to establish this scenario that she has said. So they theoretically have not pled themselves out of court if they could still go get discovery and that discovery reveals that someone was motivated by a discriminatory factor.
If you find that they've not pled themselves out of court, then we're left with the question of, since we provided evidence that we did not discriminate against her on the basis of her age, it's her burden to respond to that with evidence, with summary judgment evidence, and that's what the court held in Miranda. And there was no evidence whatsoever, not anything of the nature that was provided in this case. And so simply as an evidentiary matter, if you agree that the pleading does pass muster, you can't agree that where we've provided evidence that we did not discriminate, that she does not now have to go back and provide evidence in response, which was the Miranda style.
Assume with Chief Justice Jefferson's and hypotheticals, there is some evidence. How does the law speak to those situations?
If there's some evidence, based upon the Fifth Circuit case law that we've relied upon, that's not the proper inquiry in the case. It simply means it's a replacement case and not a risk case, and it's not a hostile environment case either, for that matter. So, based upon the Albemarle case and the Corey versus Brady, those cases would preclude that. But
why does that mean you ignore the motivation of one supervisor but adopt the motivation of the other? And how do you decide which one?
If that case ever comes before the court.
Or do you have just an entity motivation that you determine?
If that case ever comes before the court, which is not presently before the court, then it perhaps it may be proper to determine that at that time. But in this case, there is no such allegation.
You don't have an opinion about how the law should treat that situation, if there's evidence of it, or those two situations?
I don't have an opinion about how that particular type of situation should be treated. I see that I've exceeded my time, and thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.